How many people have, like, I don't know what to ask exactly. How many people have, like, experience in one or several other programming languages? Like, okay, something like, what language? Well, there's few enough. I can just shout out what your languages are. Like C, Java, MATLAB, Mathematica. Pardon?
C and Fortran.
C, Fortran, nice, good. You look younger than that.
It's maybe more of a sign of writing my undergraduate than actual age. Yeah.
Anybody else? Shout out a language, love a language, hate it. Pardon? PHP, nothing wrong with PHP or JavaScript. Cool, okay, good.
Some of them.
Okay, good, okay, that's fine. Okay, so let's start by, so I think it would be easiest to do this for you to try to follow along using the JupyterHub notebooks that we run off of the Symmetry machine. So you do that by going to, if you're on the PI resident network, I think, or probably EduRoam, if you go to, https://symmetry.pi.local, that should do the trick. It should take you to, well, actually, so probably the first time you go there, your browser will warn you that the security certificate is sketchy. It's hard to see the URL bar. So it's symmetry.pi.local is the URL. Anybody able to log into JupyterHub? Okay, so this is your regular PI credentials, so the usual.
What is the Symmetry Network exactly?
So Symmetry is a high performance computing system, or like a cluster that we have. It actually lives at the University of Waterloo.
Okay.
But it's ours. And it has 3,000 cores and a bunch of compute power, bunch of memory, and some fast local disks. They're kind of slow today for some reason. Yeah. And it's basically kind of meant to provide pretty quick response, kind of mid-scale computing needs for people in the building. So if you're interested, then definitely you can drop a line to help@pitp.ca or come see me or Eric. So then JupyterHub is one of the things that we run on the head node of that cluster, and you can either run directly there or you can submit jobs that run on the nodes that are behind that front node. Okay, so if you log in, it should take you to a listing of your home directory.
From the head node?
Please, head node.
Oh, yeah, sorry. It gives you, yes, of course. Yeah, so that's right. So you can start a kernel on the head node. So that should then take a minute to tell you that it's starting up. Okay, and then.
So we log in with the PI email.
Yeah, that's right. Just the username part of it, not the at stuff. Okay, so this is maybe a little bit of a it's one of maybe the more complicated ways of running Python code, but it's becoming really popular especially among research folks because it is a nice kind of interactive development environment and a nice way of communicating your results with your colleagues. I guess what is the best way? Um, So what I'm wondering is, I created a notebook that you could follow along with, so that you don't have to type everything that I type, and you can scroll back and stuff. Trying to think of the best way to give it to you. One second. So I think this might be the best way. So under the in Jupyter Hub, if you go under the new menu, this lets you start up. At the top, the top part of the menu here is a bunch of different what are called kernels that let you that will start up in new notebooks. But down at the bottom, there's also the option to run a terminal. So if you do that, you get
which one?
So under new at the bottom is a terminal.
Not here. Right.
And so if you go, and it should take you, let's see, so if you go cd, it should take you to your home directory. And then if you go cp for copy, squiggle dlang, so from my home directory, python-intro, intro to python.py ID. And copy that to your home directory. That should be a reasonable way of doing this. I'm going to launch in and hope that.
So where do we see it back onto?
Okay, right. So once I'm sorry. So we were looking at we had the terminal. If you go back to the, so go back to the previous tab, like where you had your home list, then you should now be able to scroll down and find that notebook that we copied in there, which was called intro to python.ipynb. And if you click on that, you know, basically, you can of course read all this by yourselves if you want. So if you want to storm out, that's fine. But so one of the nice, I thought I would start with a couple of the nice features of this notebook interface. One is that, as you can see, you can sort of mix kind of typesetting or like text with code. So a couple of basics for navigating this interface.
Actually, before we move on, it's possibly a silly question. We were just seeing the access files you had here. Is that universal? Like, if I go to someone's directory, can I see what they have? Or
it depends on how each person has set up their permissions on their home directories.
Okay.
You shouldn't be able to, though.
Okay. Yeah. Well, don't worry about someone, you know.
Yeah, we set that so only the user has access to their own home directory.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So but you know, I'm a sharing sort of individual, so I don't have any secrets. So basically, some of the navigation things I sort of listed, but if you see, what is it? If you hit enter on one of the like typeset cells, you can edit it. It uses this little language called Markdown that is kind of like sort of similar to HTML, and
it's like a page.
So you can, you know, sort of make things bold or computer type or whatever. And then basically shift enter or shift return kind of runs whatever's in your cell. So kind of getting to the meat of it, you can switch between typing code and typing Markdown so if you're in a cell, if you hit escape, it takes you into this kind of different mode. And if you do If you type M, it turns it into a markdown cell. And if you do Y, it turns it into a code cell. I understand M stands for markdown. I don't know why Y stands for code. And then essentially, if you run, yeah, whenever you run it, it runs whatever's in that cell in the current environment. There's a bunch of, I listed a bunch of the basic things I could think of, but it's always hard to sort of write down everything you know about a language. So comments start with a hash. You don't need to declare the types of variables in Python, which is really nice. But they still do have types, so it still matters, but you don't really have to be explicit about it all the time, like you do in languages like C or Fortran. So a bunch of the usual kind of fundamental types exist, like you may have seen in other languages, like strings. So this whole paragraph is declaring a bunch of variables and assigning them initial values. They're all different types. So this one's the first two are both strings. You can use double quotes or single quotes. Integers, floating point, you can use, a bunch of the usual kind of notations. And so if I run this, so in this notebook interface, if you just type the name of a variable, its value will get printed out. Now, Python has another couple of built-in data types that are really handy and used everywhere in the language, called lists and tuples. And so lists are just declared with these square brackets, and tuples are declared with the round brackets. They're very similar in a lot of ways. The main difference basically is that lists you can modify and tuples you can't. So let's see. Now, some handy functions include type. So if you go type and a variable name, it'll tell you the type that variable has. So if you've sort of forgotten what that is, you can either be like, why isn't it doing what it's supposed to? Or why can't I make it uppercase? Well, because it's a list.
Can't make it uppercase.
Another super useful function is this len, which tells you the length of things. And in Python, there's kind of there's lots of sort of like conventions or like ideas or idioms in the language, and one of them is that usually it's an idea called duck typing. Which is that if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. So if something has many elements, those should all act the same. And that thing is called, that concept is called an iterable. So it's something that you can iterate through. So usually things like lists and tuples and other things like that act the same. So, they all have a len. You can iterate through them in the same way, as I'll show you in a second. And sometimes this has funny effects, as we'll see in a bit. This idea of duck typing is like one of the kind of ideas in Python. So unlike some languages, iterables are all indexed from 0. So let me just print. Let me just print out what a list is, because I've sort of skipped over that a little bit. So So I've created this variable called alist that has an integer, and a string. I can append stuff on the end with .append. So again, you know, Python is also takes this, has some elements of being object oriented. So the idea is that like there's your variable list has different sort of things you can do to it by going a list dot, you know, append or extend, insert, other sort of operations on the list. Now it is kind of, it's a little bit odd that to get the length of it, you then don't go, you know, a list.len. Don't think that works, doesn't work. The len is kind of a built-in thing. So there is just sort of a little bit of a kind of just like two ways of doing it that doesn't necessarily make sense. Yeah.
Well, there's text. So you got text with this and text with this. So what's the difference?
No difference.
Oh.
Yeah, they both work equivalently. It's so it's handy because you can take a digression for strings for a second. So it's handy because you can go, if you want to have double quotes in your string, you can start the string with single quotes and vice versa. So, you know, if you go like that, then that works. There's another thing, which is if you have, if you start with triple quotes or triple double quotes, you can do multi-line strings. So, you know, it gives you the ability to like put in your code long strings. So like if you have like an explanation or something, you can type it out. And this is the way it's converted it is said this string backslash n, like new line, this goes on, backslash new line, and on. Okay, so yeah.
The append operation you did.
Right.
It has something like dot append, and then the thing you wanted to append. Could you have also written that as like append, and then open the function in some form? Because like you said, length is like length bracketing around the list. Could you append?
Oh yeah, good question. I don't know. Let's find out. It looks like append is not a built-in, so I guess not is the answer. So in addition to using append, there's a bunch of other ones, like there's extend, which lets you glue one list onto another list. So if you have a list, and instead of adding a single element, you want to add, you know, 42, 43, 44, you can do that. Or because plus ought to exist, you can add a list to another list. So you could, if you go a list plus 5, 6, 7, that produces a new list that has those two things joined together. However, it hasn't changed the original list, so a list is still the same. You could, however, go, you know, a list equals a list plus that, and then it's changed. Okay.
So you can comment on a list 2 equal goodbye.
Pardon me?
There was a list 2 equal goodbye. What?
Okay, yeah, good question. I think I didn't.
So a list 2 should give you the third entry at least.
Right, okay.
Reason.
Let me go back up to there. I might not have actually run that cell. Okay, yeah, so sorry, because I was talking about changing elements of a list. So if you index the 2, so the third element in the list, that will, you can change it to a different value. And like, so, right, so then you can see, you know, that it's changed that element. Now, a funny thing about this notebook interface is that it doesn't show you the result of running it top to bottom. It shows you the result of running it. You know, it's basically modifying a state behind it, and it's showing you the current state, you know. So if you run the cells out of order, you can get results that look really weird and unexpected. It's kind of a problem with this notebook interface.
Even though does it run it sequentially?
Yeah, so there's options, like, so under kernel, I think there's like the option to restart and clear output or restart and run everything. So, you know, there's sort of ways around it, and it also has a counter here about which, you know, that sort of goes up by one each time you enter. So there's sort of things that tell you what's going on, but it is still a fundamental source of confusion.
It's the same as like Mathematica, for example, notebooks.
Yeah, right. You know, it's nice in that you can go back and run, you know, if you have like some long running thing or a long, you can go back and like redo one part of it or reset something to a different value and see what happens down below. But then, you know, it can also lead to confusion. Okay. Okay, so I guess I also wanted to, going back to the kind of flow I was looking at, I was going to show that if you try to modify a tuple, like which is sort of like a list but with round brackets, you get a bug report, and I wanted to sort of show you the different parts of that as well. So it looks kind of terrifying or like gibberish, but they all basically have the same structure where it says there's some kind of like some category of error and then some description of where in the code it came from. And this can be many lines long if you have like one function that calls another function, that calls another function, and something happens in the bottom one, then it sort of explodes all the way back. And it tells you sort of the whole chain of events, which is handy for tracking down bugs and codes, but sometimes hard to read. And then basically some description that's more or less cryptic about what the actual problem was. And in this case, it was tuple object does not support item assignment, so which means like you're not allowed to change the elements in a tuple.
Why would you use a tuple over a list? I guess if you don't want it to change, maybe.
Yeah, mostly there.
Because you can pass it to a function.
Yeah, they're slightly, they have some kind of, they're like quite integrated with the language in some ways. So in some cases, like you sort of have no choice but to get a tuple. But yeah, good general question. Why would you want that? It turns out that strings are also immutable, so like you can't change the elements of a string. I'm not sure if I should just like basically keep scrolling through this notebook, or if we should like, if there are other like things you want to hit, or things you're particularly interested in, or whatever. I guess, you know, I'll just keep rolling, I guess. But you know, if you want to redirect, please feel free. It's your time. Python has some of these. You know, this is another one of the idioms, is this one called packing or unpacking, where you can sort of use, you can set multiple variables at a time by, and this is basically like saying one tuple is set to be equal to another tuple. So internally this, or like what, how Python actually treats this is to say this tuple of ABC is set to this tuple 1, 2, 3. And so, you sometimes see things like this in codes, especially things like, you know, if you're like setting the, you're creating an image and you want to set the height and width of it, you know, then you can make it like 1,000 by 1,000. And it's kind of just like, you can write it in one line instead of two lines. And it sort of, you know, makes some sense in the context of the, of what you're writing, because you're, you know, those things intrinsically sort of go together and it's convenient to write them in that way. So this occasionally leads to really confusing looking code, because if you can write totally valid A comma B equals B comma A, that swaps the value, that, you know, has the result of swapping the values of the variables A and B, because it's saying, you know, what it's basically saying is take variable B and A and pack them up into a tuple and then unpack them, setting the first one to A and the second one to B. So it's kind of bizarro looking, but it's, you know, a thing that you'll occasionally see in codes. And one big reason why this is popular or heavily used is that you can use, when you return values from functions, you can return multiple values in this way. So often, if you call a function, it can return two things, and you want to assign those two things to two different variables. This is, you know, a really common place this comes up in practice. So you could imagine, say, a function that computes the sine and the cos of a thing, of an angle, and returns both of those values to you rather than making a separate sine and cos call. And that might be more efficient because, you know, in the guts of the computation, you can easily extract both the sine and the cos, for example. Okay. oh yeah, I just a little light humor. You can use a bunch of Unicode symbols for variable names. It's perverse, don't do it. But there's like 100-page long list of the Unicode characters you can use for variables, including most of like many thousands of Chinese, Japanese, and Korean ideograms. So if you want to make your code like totally inscrutable, you can use those. you can use emojis and string literals. I digress. Unfortunately, you can't start variables. I think you can't even include emojis in variable names. So it's truly a lost opportunity, and I'm sure we'll fix it in Python 4.
It's on the top of the list, right?
It's on the top of my list. Okay. Let's hide this. Yeah, okay, there we go. So loops brings up indentation. So in Python, whitespace matters. It's sometimes a pain. But basically, as we'll see in a bit, if you want to write a loop, for loops are probably the most common, as in many other languages. So, you know, basically the structure of that is very much like the languages, you know, for variable name in some list or set of things, values to give for that value, assign that I, and then run whatever's in the loop. Now, and what is inside that loop is determined by the indentation. So, let's say you want to compute the sum or whatever. If you do sum plus equals I like that, you'll get the sum correctly. But if you have no indentation like that, you'll get only, that's not, then that line is no longer in the loop, and it only runs once at the end. So indentation is what determines what's in the loop. So it's a little bit gnarly. And the you can use different amounts of indentation, but four spaces is like by far the strongly preferred option. Okay, so
excuse me.
So for iterating over a range, this function range, this built-in function range, is really useful. you can so let's see, if you go just range 10, oh, interesting, it doesn't actually do it, doesn't print it, but you can turn it into a list, and it will give, and it gives you the list from 0 to not including 10. You can, so for any built-in function, if you type the name of the thing in question mark, you'll get a little bit of help, a little help text about it, more or less cryptic, depending on the function. So, you know, for example, you can go range from some starting value to some stopping value in steps of some other value. So you could, you know, count from, you can go.
Sorry, you, when you click to get the out.
Yeah, did, so range question mark is what you, brings up that little, that help text. So you can, you know, range one to.
Create a new line.
So if you hit escape, it turns to blue, and then if you hit B, it'll create a new cell below where you are. And A for above, X deletes the current cell.
Sorry, what did you say, sir?
Sorry, so A creates a cell above, B creates a cell below, and X deletes your current cell. Yeah. Okay, so. Okay, good. Okay, so. you know, you can iterate over tuples or lists or whatever. turns out, you know, strings are iterable, so you can get, you can loop over the letters in a string if you want. A couple things. So there's this function enumerate that that's usually used like this in a list. So here we've got, instead of just for I or whatever, it's iterating over two things, right? So it's iterating over I and letter. And what happens is as you go through the loop, the value I is, it starts at zero and increases by one each time, while the second thing goes through the list or whatever you're iterating over. So it kind of like gives you the index of the thing you're dealing with and the value at the same time. So it's really handy for, like, if you're like adding up two lists or sometimes putting the result of a computation some other place. Or if you want to, oh, so let's use it. Let's go. instead of just printing the letter, I want to print it I plus one times. So, yeah, let's make it. Let's do. So, you know, basically, it lets you say, lets you sort of alter what you're doing in the loop based on how many times you've gone through the loop. And so this, and here I took this letter is a string with one character in it. And if you go that times six, it makes a string that's six characters, like six letters, six copies of that letter. That's, you know, what Python programmers think is sensible, which might tell you more about them than anybody else. You know, so if you go like, so if you have some string, ABC times 10, it makes 10 copies of ABC. Similarly, that works for, as you might guess, that works for all iterables. So if you have like a list, 1, 2, 3, and you do that times 10, you get a big long list that repeats 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and so on. Do that only times 3, so that it's not quite so big. Okay, so now, the thing that occasionally comes up is you're writing some code, and if you're writing like a for loop, then we saw that indentation matters, right? So it turns out that you can't just have nothing inside of a loop. You have to have that, the language basically demands that there's something in there. And if you, but if you're in, you know, you're writing some code and you're like, oh, I'm gonna, I have to do something there, but then I'm gonna go on and write the rest of this function before I come back and think about what that is. If you wanna just like hold your place, you can use this term pass that just says like do nothing right now. And it like syntactically holds that place and like, like satisfies the language need to have something there without actually doing anything. So it's like a no operation. Okay. One other thing I forgot to add to the notebook, which, well, many other things, no doubt, but there's a special value in Python called none, which is like in C, it's like null. In JavaScript, it's like undefined, sort of. Undefined is really deep in JavaScript. And it basically just means like, so you can it's a perfectly normal variable, like you can set a equals none. And it, if you try to print its value in the notebook, it just does nothing, which is kind of frustrating. If you print it, I think it prints none. So that's at least a bonus. And there are also some other built-ins I should have mentioned are false and true. True and false, I suppose, which are the usual like Boolean variables. So in C and other languages, they sort of use 0 or 1 for those. In Python, they just have these special symbols, true and false. And true is different than false, than none, and false is also different than none. Like none is sort of a different thing. It's not true, it's not false, it's nothing. Okay, so another really common like Python-ism or idiom in the language is these things that are called list comprehensions. And basically, they're for doing operations on every element in a list. So in a language like C or Fortran or whatever, let's say you had, you know, a list of the values from 0 to 9, and you wanted to compute their squares and create a new list with those values. So in a language like C or Fortran or something, you would create your where the array where your result is going to go, and then for each value in that you would, you know, compute the square and stick it on the end of the list. And then at the end you'd have, you know, 0 squared, 1 squared, 2 squared, 3 squared, 4 squared, 5 squared, and so on. In Python, the like by far the most common way to write that would be using this sort of syntax, which is a list comprehension. So it basically says, it's sort of like a for loop turned inside out. You have the value you want to have in the result for basically the part of the for loop. So, and this just lets you write that whole, you know, that whole, instead of taking three lines to do it, you do it in one line. So, you know, basically, the idea is you, this list is, the squares is going to be a list that has, each element is going to be the value squared for each of the items and values. So it, you know, basically lets you produce a list of results from a list of inputs. And there's also the option of putting a test on each value. So it'll, so what this does is pulls each item out of the values list and says, if that mod 2 equals 0, so in other words, if it's even, run the thing, like run this and store the result. Otherwise, just skip that element. So I wrote one that just computes the square of the even numbers. So it goes through each of those elements in that values list. And if it's even, keeps it and computes its value squared. So that star star means square, or means, you know, to the power of. And so then, you know, the result is then this list that has 0 squared, 2 squared, 4 squared, 6 squared, 8 squared. OK. And in some ways, I'm focusing on the things about Python that are, or like some of the idioms that are really common and a little bit strange looking if you come from other languages. No semicolons. They're actually optional, so you can include them if you like. So now, of course, a very important part of any language, functions. So functions are defined using def, and once you have defined a new function, it goes into your namespace and it's available like any other function. As in many other languages, when it's defined, you have a list of the parameters you expect to get, and then a colon at the end of the line.
Excuse me.
And then, you know, indentation defines what is in the function. and the return is mandatory. If you want to return something, then you must say return. If you just fall off the end of the function, then it returns none. This function doesn't do much. It takes three elements. You don't have to say what type you're expecting, which is sometimes good and sometimes bad, because you often have in mind what kind of a thing you want, and if a user gives you something different, then the results can be odd. All this function does is prints the three values in order and then returns them backwards, right? Remember how I said before that from a function you can return a tuple? Well, that's exactly what this is doing. You might think, that's kind of silly. It doesn't make any, why would you want to do that? So let's make this do something more interesting. So instead of returning values backwards, maybe we want to return like A times B, A times B times C, you know. Or maybe you want to, you know, I don't know. You can imagine times when you want to return multiple things from a function. Now, oh yeah, what did I give it? I guess, you know, so there's an example. I was thinking, oh, okay, we're gonna get passed in numbers and I'm gonna multiply them together. But, you know, if you call it with number one, string two, and the value three, what is one times a string times three? Well, it's three copies of the string. So there you go.
What happens if you pass in a string multiplied by a float or something?
Yeah, good question. I'm gonna guess it explodes. Because that wouldn't make any sense. So let's see. Yeah, so it explodes. Can't multiply a sequence by non-int of type float. Even though, so I made that a float by just putting the dot. Like people in Python, you don't need to go 3.0 or whatever. People often will omit the .0. So even though, you know, it's 3 versus 3.0, it's determined by the type. You know, it's not determined by the value. It's just that, like, multiplying a string by a floating point doesn't make sense, even though for a specific floating point it might make perfect sense, or at least as much sense as an integer. But you know, it's determined by the type. Like, types really do matter in Python, even though they sort of look like they don't. Couple things about scoping. I don't know if this matters well, or if will mean much to you, but when you declare, so in a for loop, right, you say, I want this new variable I that's going to take on this set of different values each time through the loop. When you, after the loop is done, that variable still exists. In some languages it doesn't. It only exists in the scope of the loop. Similarly,
is its value the last element in the list it ran through, or?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, in this example, if you, yeah, exactly. So, you know, the three times through the loop, it would first have the value 0, then the value 1, then the value 2, and then once the loop is done, it, still has that value, the last value it was left with. Similarly, it might be more surprising that in some languages this doesn't happen, but if you're inside like a block and you redeclare this variable B and give it a new value, it still ends up with the last value you assigned to it. In C, the B inside of that if statement would actually be a different variable than the one outside the statement. So in Python, I think that makes more sense, actually. Okay. Functions can also have these keyword args or quargs. So you can either, you know, basically you can either have a list of variables that you want, or you can also give them kind of names like and default values. So and this comes up all the time in science, where there's some, you want to have some function and there's some reasonable default that is correct most of the time, but in some cases you might want to break it. So you know, maybe you usually want to do your computation with GR, but otherwise you might want to do some other theory of gravity. So this lets you, this example doesn't, I should have probably shown more. So basically, you know, the syntax is you can have variables that are passed by their position like before, but you can also have ones that are passed by the name. So when you call it, so when somebody calls your function, they only have to pass the values that don't have the equals, like that aren't keyword args. So in this case, like if you try to call it with only one argument, it'll fail. It says you need at least two of these positional args. So in other words, you need to give it values for A and B. But if you omit C and one that I just called debug instead of D, they get whatever default values you listed. And then if you want, you can pass in a specific value for those keyword arguments. So, you know, I'm going to pass in 1 and 2 and then set C equal to 3. And conveniently, you can list them in different orders, whatever sort of makes sense. Whichever order you like, whether it makes sense or not. And it's especially nice for if you have a function that has, so two things. If you have a function that has a lot of arguments, it's kind of easier to keep track if you can pass them by name. And then if you later change the definition of that function, you know, I add another one. Dark energy is -1. If you're calling that function and you don't care about dark energy, you don't have to change anything in the calling code. I mean the equation of state of dark energy. Okay. We are at the hour. Do you want to wrap up? Do you want to keep going? Keep going for a bit. Leave if you want. I'll keep going for a bit. It doesn't. The notebook sort of runs out in a little bit, so I won't keep you here all day. I promise. So we saw already that lists and tuples are these built-ins. So another couple of more built-ins are dictionaries and sets. Dictionaries are super common, partly because they're used like the way that those quargs or keyword argument functions are implemented is with dictionaries. So they're again kind of an intrinsic part of the language, or how the language is implemented at least. And a dictionary basically just maps one value to another value. So you can create a dictionary either this way, where it's a kind of quark style, like it looks like you're calling a function, and that creates a mapping from the string to whatever value you gave it. So, right, it's a little bit odd. So imagine, you know, if you had give an example here, like you've got a variable with value 2, and now you want to create a dictionary, and it looks like you're saying, I want the value 2 to map to the string what, but that's not actually what happens. It ends up being the string A gets mapped to the string what. So it's kind of like, it's just an oddity of the way creating a dictionary that way works. There's another way of creating dictionaries, which is this curly braces style. And there you go, curly brace, the key, colon, then the value that it maps to. And then if you want to make multiple at once, you can go comma, and then, you know, two maps to seven, or whatever. And the way these are, right, and then in curly, if you do it with curly braces, then, you know, it sort of works the way you'd expect. If this is, if A is two, and you go A maps to yes, then in fact it's two maps to yes. Okay. So you can look up things in a dictionary using square brackets.
How do you change something with the dictionary?
Ooh, good question. I believe you can go like that, like that you can set it with.
But however, you have hello, how does it, the dictionary, what do I do to make it world? Do I do?
Oh, okay, yeah, you use use this, let's see, so if we make this one, so if I go, that's sort of like, how do you use it? Like, so if you go D hello, then it should do world. Now, if you do, if you look for something that doesn't exist in it, then you'll get a key error. It says, I don't have, I don't know what zero is. Or there's, you know, zero doesn't map to anything. Now, I was just wondering whether, is it sensitive to type? So if you go, so D2 exists in this dictionary. Does D2.0 exist in the dictionary? What do you think? I'm gonna suspect no, right? Oh.
Does.
That's odd. That was actually not what I was expecting. So that's different. Python has surprises, even for people who think they're fairly seasoned in it. Okay, and then there's.
So when you said DL, where does it read the word? It's the next word.
Pardon me?
Wait, how does that word? When you say D hello, it doesn't return you the hello.
Yeah, that's right. So it.
In other words,
it
next. Do you have a disk?
Yeah, so there. It's basically like it's a dictionary that maps. It's a bijection, I guess. It maps, you know, one thing, the one thing to the. To the next, so, or like, rather maps like a left-hand side to a right-hand side, like
okay, so
there's, you know, yeah, it's colon. Yeah, that's right, it can't go, that's right. It's just a single pair.
It's just pairing up.
Yeah, so it's like a single, a one-step mapping, I guess, like another way of thinking about it. And, right, okay, so, and if you, there's a, get function that lets you look it up, but if it doesn't exist, you can give it some fallback. You know, so that says try to look up the key two in the dictionary, and if that doesn't work, return fallback. Right. So I think two exists here, but if we look for 19, we should get fallback. Right? So which is kind of handy if, like, you know, you're. I often use this if I want, like, to give, if I want to plot things in different colors depending on what some variable is. Yeah.
So you could apply to like 2.1 or 2.2.
Good question. So like because 2.0 worked, what does 2.2 do?
Yeah, or could you assign a key to that?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Right. It there are some rules about. So, you know, we can make 2.2 map to 98, and that'll work fine.
We use the odd characters in there, like Chinese characters.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, you can, because you can, because
for a dictionary lookup, I guess it makes sense.
Yeah, that's right. It's you can put, there are rules about what you can use as keys in dictionaries. You can't do anything in the world, but you can definitely do strings. So Unicode works fine.
does it go both ways? Like if in the example where you had hello and world paired up, if I called world, would it return hello or no?
Nope, okay. It's just a one-way mapping, yeah. I guess I shoot that for you. Your left to right.
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, good, good, good.
This is a question. What if you really want 2.2, right?
Yeah.
You said, give me whatever is in 2.2.0.0.1.
Yeah.
It returns the same, whatever is in 2.2. What if you actually want whatever? You don't,
yeah.
You don't have that key. You haven't set that key, but
yeah.
You want it to return, oh, I don't know what that is.
Uh-huh.
You do that.
Right. Good. I think... that's a good question. I think it might be that I gave too many digits. And so let's... let's just test for a second. So I think if I run that value, the actual value that it evaluates to is 2.2. Because I think... So if I went... I think it's just too many digits of accuracy to fit in a double or whatever. Like... You know, if I go like that, that works. But then at some point, like you run out of, it runs out of precision to tell the difference between.
Yeah, but I mean, you're telling me, give me the value and on this key, right? But you haven't created that key. So why are you getting the value that, you know?
Oh, you did, you signed it.
Well, you have 2.2, but you.
Right, yeah, yeah. Like,
is there some...
if I only have the value, like if I have 2.2 in there, why does. So if I ran this, it will not work because that value isn't, you know, 2.200001 isn't in the dictionary.
Okay.
But at some point you basically run out of precision to represent the one, and it really, where does it run out? There it runs out. And like at that point, you typed this long value, but that's not representable. And so, you know, the nearest thing that is representable is 2.2. So then it, like, from then on, it really is the value 2.2. And that's, I mean, in detail, it's because the built-in float data type is a, like a double, like a 64-bit double. So, you know, it has limited precision.
Okay.
it's...
What's the sort of example usage of this dictionary function?
I'm
having a hard time thinking of when I'd want to...
Yeah, yeah, sure. Gosh, they...
Could you store, say, cinnamon text setting? Like to...
Sorry?
Take one word and apply all... related words, for example.
Yeah, sure. I mean, one that let's see. They're often used for like for setting configuration values, like you know, line width equals 7. You know, line width equals 7, color equals red, blah, blah, blah. So if you're building plots, it's really handy to, they're used for that sort of thing. So often if I'm doing plots and I want to change the color based on, you know, some other property or like, I often deal with astronomical data, so it's taken in different bands, and I always want, you know, I always want one band to be plotted in the same color. So that's a kind of mapping that, where it's like, you know, J band becomes red and H band becomes green and whatever.
That's balance.
Yeah.
so those sorts of things. Okay, so I had a couple of things about sets. Sets actually aren't used that much in the language, so it's not worth talking about. We can wrap up, or I can talk about, I can jump into the numerical Python and plotting stuff. It's kind of big though.
It's good to wrap up.
Yeah, okay, let's wrap up. Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah,
thanks.